This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
This first slide, I want to draw attention to this just as a preamble to this discussion. We approach the field of medicine, pathology, biology carefully as architects because in recent times the distance between our fields have maybe grown wider, maybe it's always been quite wide, we don't know. But I wanted to draw this attention to this etching from 1607 entitled The Incision. It's a scene from an anatomical theater, and it comes from a time period where medicine, interest in biology, the human form, and architecture were not quite as distant as it may be today. So, next slide. Interesting. So, we're rewinding the tape about 400 years. We have this incredible drawing by Leonardo, and it's a drawing that so many people have seen. It's something that we know of. But the principles lodged in this drawing, I think, might be a clue to how we might begin to see what we might share as common ground. We have this drawing of man inscribed inside a circle, man the measure of all things, and based on principles of proportion from the sole surviving book on architecture from antiquity, from Vitruvius, where proportions that are somehow embedded or hidden in the human form is a kind of, the human body itself is a kind of repository of divine proportions and becomes a kind of model, if you will, for how we begin to proportion and structure our buildings. So, next slide. So Francesco Di Giorgio, also 16th century, and it's kind of self-explanatory here. You have this human form, this vessel with that is embedded with divine proportions that is then overlaid on tops of these very pragmatic starting points, if you will, for the layout of a church. Next slide. It is no accident that you have Leonardo's drawings investigating the anatomy of the human body. And then his on-again, off-again friend, Donato Bramante, both begin to look a little deeper. So it's not just the human body and its figure overlaid onto the proportion, but what's underneath that body? What's inside that body? And even today, we have the sectional drawing, which is still one of the fundamental tools of the designer. And it comes from this period where there was this very odd intersect between medical interests, investigation of human form, and the thing that surrounds human form, another kind of body. So. And this is more anecdotal, but you have on the left Claude Perrault, the designer of the east facade of the Louvre, and Christopher Wren on the right, who bear remarkable similarity to each other, who were both the foremost, well, two of the foremost architects of their time. But what you may not know of, if you know of these names from the architectural survey class, was they were also two of the foremost physicians of their time. And next slide. So you have these etchings by Claude Perrault that was engaged in vivisection and studying anatomy and studying the natural world. And incidentally, not many people know, but Claude Perrault succumbed. He died from a rare bacteria contracted from the hump of a camel during one of his dissections. So they had their revenge, actually. So we rewind the tape forward 400 years. A lot happened in that time. But we begin to see things like x-rays, where we begin to understand the human body in a fundamentally different way, that it's not a body like a building, but it is transparent, it is a field, it is a continuum of networks. It's, and where exactly the outside is and the inside is, it's not so clear anymore in the 20th century. We have the MRI, where we begin to see the human body as a continuous fluid network. And finally, perhaps most catastrophically, we have the first DNA fingerprint in 1989. This is from Dolly. And next slide. And this is really going to be the last thing that I leave you with. You have Eduardo Kac with his greatest piece of art, Alba, the GFP bunny, next slide, which glows in the dark. So certain genetic strands from green phosphorescent jellyfish were extracted, and some gene therapy was done to the rabbit, and when you turn off the lights, it glows in the dark. So what does all this mean? And how does architecture and biology reassess what might be embedded in the logics of life? And what could we learn from the logics of organic matter? And simultaneously, what might go the other direction? And so here we start this carefully and with the green bunny. And I'm going to ask the first question. So we've prepared about 12 questions, and we did this somewhat democratically in a kind of furious back and forth of emails in the past week. And I'm not sure how many of them we're going to get to. We might end up spending the entire time discussing just one question, or we might end up discussing all 12. But I'm going to have to improvise a little bit and see what happens. So to start us off, this first question is... addressed to both Cecil and Peter, and it is a concern that has been expressed actually through a quote that was sent during this furious exchange of emails in the past week, quote by Peter Jones here, and regards the role of the human agent, whether it be pathologist or architect, in relationship to the fog of experience. Peter presents us with this beautiful quote from the Victor Weisskopf. And it starts, what is beautiful in science is the same that is beautiful in Beethoven. There is a fog of events, and suddenly you see a connection. It expresses a complex of human concerns that goes deeply to you, that connects things that were always in you that were never put together before. It is the experience through which we do our work that is of question here, and our first step in this conversation. And it has been expressed that as biology becomes more specialized and automated, it may become somewhat detached from the subject, which is the organism or the cell that is being studied. So in this fog of data, in this fog of observable experience, what is the connection that is made? And is there a parallel to the specializations that have been happening in architecture as well? The computer has changed many things, and we're inundated with progressively more technical criteria. So in the fog of architectural events, what is the connection that is being made? And perhaps we could just start with this, and maybe we give this over to Cecil.
Okay, thank you, David. Before I get into that question, just on your slides, the two comments I have, just to warm up the audience as well for what lies ahead, I would say the sectional drawing is no more. That is a classical world of two-dimensional compilation of data, and in the best work today in architecture, if you really look at it, the sectional drawing is really void. It doesn't mean much. You have to look at things in a new way. So I just posit that. The other one is Christopher Wren, great reputation as an architect. The truth is that if you look at the papers recently discovered of Robert Hooke, which was only a few months ago, it effectively, and Wren made his reputation on St. Paul's and the dome and a new form that had not been seen. But it was the persistent pushing of Robert Hooke, who invented elasticity and material performance, if you like. He was the first to see it and understand it. That actually was the secret force behind Wren. And in fact, it jointly should be a credit to Hooke and Wren, which was interesting. I was talking to the lady who discovered these papers recently, and it's fantastic. Anyway, I just leave those two thoughts, that architecture always gets promoted by materialities. That's one thought. And the other one is in the new architecture, the section is questionable, which leads us to then how do you represent it and what does it mean? Coming back to the fog of architecture, if that's what the question was, architecture, I think, above all, has a lot of fog around it. It has stylistic bubbles that we get trapped in. It has, unlike a lot of other professions, a political angle, and because big buildings are to do with big money, it's a lot of power broking politically as well. And interesting enough, though it's an international concern, it's actually a very local activity, architecture. It's to understand the local power structures that enables it to happen. Having said all that, and that's the fog that can blur what it's all about, if you cut through it, and if you cut through the fog, it's literally, and fog's a good metaphor that you use, it's like being on a mountainside and the fog is there. And how do you track your way through it? And what you do is you start to observe patterns, then you probe your path to find out whether there's a recognition in what you're finding, and then you actually see a deeper pattern and find your path through it. And that is all to do with the search for a form. And right at the heart of architecture is the pursuit of form. We will debate perhaps later what form means, and I don't mean shape. Form is something more dynamic. It is something that's almost intangible, in fact, intangible in many ways, and it's not what you think it is. It's not about shape. But at the heart of architecture is always looking for form. And as we have got more sophisticated with materialities, environmental ambience in buildings today, the intangible is very tangible today to environmental scientists. The buildings become a complex system, and form is a hybrid of all of that. And finding form is really, for me, where I clear the fog. And in fact, stylistically, form has dropped off the architectural agenda, unless it was in an obvious way, like Frank Gehry brought it back. And architecture went into landscape discussions, organizational, other discussions. But the focus on form is the only way I clear the fog, personally. And whether that is what Peter does with Bhaji, I don't know. But that is how I would chart my way through the fog, is in an investigation of form and what that means.
So, Peter, I'm kind of playing the proxy, because this actually is the question that comes out of your email. So I was wondering if you might want to follow up on this here.
Yeah, and you were very sneaky because you combined two questions and posed them. But
I
don't want to appear like a Luddite. The sort of technologies and sort of blanket approaches that we take to analyze masses of data within individual systems are incredibly powerful and useful. So just quickly refer to this and then answer to your question on form. What you're looking at behind me is essentially a small array of many genes, up to, I think, 15,000 genes. Each one of those spots is a gene. And the different colors tell you whether the gene is turned on or off or sort of neutral. So you can take a sample and apply it to that platform and ask at a particular moment in time how this single process is regulated or not. Now, the problem with this is it's almost like a cross-section in a way. It's dimensionless in that it's at a particular moment in time. It doesn't take into account site specificity. So I think we're facing these very similar problems. How do you superimpose this onto three-dimensional form? And that's a major problem that I think we're facing. It's incredibly powerful technology, and we use it. Probably most of the biologists in this room use it.
And is that a true snapshot of a section?
This is a true snapshot of a biological process
right. Within
a cell or a tissue at a particular moment in time.
But not actually a physical section. It's a mapping of data at a certain moment.
So this is an extraction of of the transcription of DNA to an intermediate, which some of which will give rise to protein, which is the basic unit, functional component of cells and tissues in life. This is a snapshot. The problem with this snapshot is that it doesn't account for noise, and noise is incredibly important in biological systems. An example I think we talked about at the NLSO, identical twins who have the same genome, if you examine their thumbprints, they're completely different, and they grew up in the same environment, same uterine environment at least. So noise had a role in creating their individual identities. This gives me a great opportunity to segue to Peter, because I think you know Peter Davis probably is the world's expert in defining site specificity, at least within the cardiovascular system, and looking at these snapshots in a much closer way. And I don't know if perhaps Peter wants to talk to that. I think the next slide may, if you go back one. So again, we, you know, the problem we're facing is the loss of dynamics, the loss of site specificity, and the importance of the environment. And Peter certainly can talk to that, if you wish.
So, David, do you want me to chip in? This
yeah, time? Peter, would you like to follow up on Peter's comments?
He's going to.
I don't know if this is on or not.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Okay. This is where that extra dimension comes into play. So the snapshot of gene regulation or gene expression, in this case the 20,000 genes, can be related to the three-dimensionality of a cell layer in a specific site in the circulation of the blood goes through, particularly the arterial circulation. What you see in the middle panels are some examples where the geometry of blood vessels, in this case arteries, are heavily predisposed to become diseased. And we're interested in the mechanism as to what makes those regions susceptible. Even when there isn't a disease present, can we actually get a fingerprint through the 20,000 genes of why they're susceptible to that particular process? So the simple message, I think, extension of what Peter has said, is to add a concrete spatial definition of that particular snapshot of the, you know, of the gene expression that's there, rather than looking at the gene expression in a totally abstract fashion without reference to a surface or to a specific site. So it interrelates with form in a biological sense in that context.
Just going back to that quote you had with the previous slide about, it was Beethoven?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What is beautiful in Beethoven? It's interesting that architecture and music have been very closely allied for a long time. And if you are a musician in the audience, if you studied Beethoven, and every musician who's ever played Beethoven would say that he's the greatest structuralist there was. His symphonies are absolutely perfect in terms of, well, what does that mean, perfect? It means no extraneous material. It's a composition that holds tension, compressions, all the physical attributes we give to structures and buildings and things. Music has always made spaces. When I listen to it, I always hear space or see spaces, feel it. And I think architecture has always been about the pursuit of a study of organization, how organization comes together. And in there, embedded and comes out of it, is form and shape and consequences. And I think where we come together, I visited Peter's studio lab. I said studio. It felt like a studio. It was unlike any lab I'd grown accustomed to think of labs only a few weeks ago. And there was a common ground. I looked through the microscope for the first time and saw cells and how it works and the architecture of cells. We use words like that. We could equally use words of engineering of cells, architecture of cells. It doesn't matter. It comes down to the organization of what was going on. And I think in the sense what the shift, the fundamental shift that has come upon us and is upon us and is irreversible, is that organization is no more being seen as linear, classically ordained, with a formal set of references. Organization is now is serial and forming itself, which is very hard to get your mind around, but that's what it does. It's self-referential. It doesn't have any global axes to plot it against. It keeps forming and has its own axes as it forms itself. And whether architecture in the bulk doesn't embrace that yet, but that is where principles of organization are being understood across the sciences. And certainly, knowing what Peter's been doing, that is where the biologists are looking at cells and growth of cells and how cells deform and form and cancer cells and all. It promotes the idea of a bespoke locality. No more is cancer generic and you go for one zapping treatment. Your cancer is individual to you. And not only just individual to you, but it's individual to the locality where it starts in you. And that's the sort of thing that is a big shift in our understanding of organization. I think if you want to pick up on that.
I think it goes back to this idea of certainly the work in my lab, which focuses on microenvironmental control of cell behavior and form. Cells throughout the body have an identical DNA blueprint, yet they behave in very different ways depending upon where they are, and they need to form these exquisite structures that have particular forms and functions. In reference to honing in on sort of site specificity and individual specificity of these environments that may be created around particular tumors, and there are ubiquitous factors that are common to the same disease within different individuals. But I truly believe that this epigenetic or environmental, controlling the local environment and how that and the architecture of that environment is going to be the way forward to unravel some of these complex networks or disease conditions that I'm speaking in front of my chair of pathology and lab medicine here, so I don't know if he's shaking his head or not. But but from our perspective, I think that is certainly one way forward, and it also speaks to what Peter's doing in terms of chasing after individual sites. And
it's interesting you raise the word pathology, because pathology is a forensic in a way, and it's interesting that the NSO is set up. I use words like a forensic into a new aesthetic. Mm-hmm. And in a way, the sort of studies you all are doing in terms of the cells and the work I've seen is a kind of forensic to me in looking at how organization gets formed and made in interesting ways that are non-linear completely.
Can we go back to the slides of the DNA? First one we had. I'm sorry to interrupt, Peter, but wanted to draw attention to something we were saying earlier. One of the things that happens, I guess, when we begin to have, a deeper understanding or look into the deeper structures of what's happening in organic matter, is a transformation from what was once understood as a vessel or a thing in space, a body with an outside and inside, with everything on the inside being mysterious and informative, versus understanding organizations or kind of a tapestry of information, if you will, here, when we begin to understand organic matter in this way. So one of the things, because there were similar transformations in the notion of the architectural diagram as well, that once organization becomes understood as something that is more abstract, one of the byproducts of that discussion has been this discussion of nonlinear organizations as a possible organization for architecture. So just wanted to bundle the conversation that was already starting to happen here and wanted to press the two of you to speak more directly to how the nonlinear and also linear models operate in both of your work.
You want to start? Okay. Well, first, a definition of nonlinear would be easy to say. Linear doesn't mean straight line. Linear means predicting something that repeats. Something that repeats is predictable. That's linear. We use that word as a shorthand, but linear means something that repeats and you can predict it. Nonlinear being something you can't repeat without, and you can't predict, so it's unpredictable. Now, in that sense, it seems hard to think that a piece of architecture is nonlinear. But in actual fact, if you enter a building and all its movements within the building, unless it's a highly functional building in a very prescribed way, it's quite nonlinear the way you read those spaces as you travel through the building. And very much a piece of architecture is about entrance and exit and movement through form, through the static form that you see. And in that sense, it's always been nonlinear, surprisingly. But what we're talking now, and your question is addressed to the very form itself being organized in a nonlinear way. And I think that strikes a deeper chord, that good nonlinear architecture, and it's still in its embryonic stage, if I'm honest, it's only happening now, but when it's good, you will have a recognition, I believe, of deeper pattern recognition. And in that we work on patterns. We recognize ideas through patterns, if you think about it. We say an argument has certain rigors. There's always a pattern recognition going on. And it's not the superficial patterns that you look at in architecture, but it's the deeper resonance that one feels. And I believe that if spaces are being compiled in a nonlinear sense, that means serial, and yet it has proportion governing it. It doesn't mean chaotic. Then I believe that our transgression of those spaces, our traverse of those spaces, will be enriched than spaces that have been formed through classical, repetitive, linear models. For our age and our contemporary age, we will be dissatisfied after we engage with a contemporary form to go back to an old form. And I think that's been demonstrated very well to a little project I did long ago, 4 years ago, in Hyde Park. There was a new pavilion done out of a new technique, and then there was the old neoclassical building. Both were acceptable in their own rigors. The neoclassical building had its simple rigor, and the new one, the contemporary form, had its own patterns of formation. But because it had a proportionate system hidden in it, it worked. It was accepted without a problem.
I mean, I think by your definition, all of us sitting here are quite linear. We're recognizable, we're sort of reproducible, we're obviously human. And there are examples and our definition of linearity certainly does still include arrays of, say, adjacent genes that are required to be linear in order to be specified in a particular pattern during development, and one class of genes that we work on are particular proteins that specify where your head and your tail is going to end up, anterior, posterior positioning. These are master regulatory genes that set up the body plan and the anterior posterior axis. The way that they work is that they're sort of released from the code in a very highly linear fashion. Protein comes along and bang, 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 there they go, and they enter a nonlinear network. And I just, there's one slide, if you go forward, Eric, go back. So this is the kind of network that we're trying to understand. So when DNA is transcribed to RNA and then up into proteins, which feed back to DNA and RNA, etc. Again, this is a snapshot in time. This is actually a protein network, a protein interacting network from yeast. So this is what you make beer with, and it's extremely complicated. And you can see maybe that there are 4,000 to 5,000 nodes. This is the kind of non-linearity that we need to try and unfurl. Again, this is a snapshot in time. It may be extended over time just to show that there are these multiple interactions. So I think our definitions of non-linear are quite different at this point. And linearity is also very important. So those genes I was talking about, those factors, they enter these non-linear networks. And I think our goal, and I think we can get help from architects and designers who see things and can pattern things in different ways, is to unravel and to track these individual proteins and the way in which they interact in time and space with multiple partners. Our definition is quite different. I think Jenny's got a question.
Yeah. No, I'm wondering if we can go back to the slide that coupled the lab with the studio real quickly. Because I think, just to sort of step back a bit, I think in a way we're in our own fog of sorts, you know. And what's interesting for me is in the early beginnings of forming how we collaborate with each other is how we begin to discuss definitions of terms, to exchange language. And in the earlier question, Cecil, you brought up the word perfection, and Peter, you brought up noise. And in terms of thinking about linear versus nonlinear models, Cecil, you speak of the monotony of perfection, the sort of linearity of that, and that there's a need for a type of turbulence, a sort of impurity to understand form or to intuit invention. And so I'm wondering, how does turbulence or these impurities enable us to find points of clarity within the fog?
Do you want to answer that?
As a, you know, pathobiologist, that's what we do day to day. We, in a very simple explanation, we compare normal processes with abnormal processes, and both inform one another. You want to know how normal works. You also want to know how abnormal works, because it's sometimes associated with disease. So the purity and the impurities are, again, very balanced, I think, in our world in terms of how we want to understand them. One might be more beautiful, I think, some of the mimetic systems that we use to model tumors. They're far more beautiful than the sort of ordered structure of, say, a normal human mammary gland versus a tumor. I mean, it sounds strange to say that a tumor is beautiful, but there is beauty in that chaos. And
I think beauty has always been the recognition of a degree of asymmetry within the bigger field of symmetry. There has always been, I think, a notion of beauty. And those pictures and places we remember best are not because they were perfectly symmetric. It's because there was a certain impurity, and in architectural terms I would use the word an asymmetry, that has a certain frisson. You remember, it's like the slight imperfection in a face as against a perfect face. You remember the imperfection slightly within that other background of symmetry. I would like to clarify something to elaborate a bit more what I meant by nonlinear, because I think it's a difficult word. Mm-hmm. I think taking your analogy of a row of genes in a row, I mean, we have columns in a building. Let's take a very banal element. A column holds up the buildings usually, and you have a row of columns. up till a few years ago, I would say that we would see, or the definition of linearity would be that space was empty. We had containers of geometry. We had rectangles. We had squares. And space was empty. And what we did then as architects would be we spaced the gap. So we would put columns in, spacing them out. They could be equally repetitive, that doesn't matter, or they could be different depending on the function of the loads coming down. But essentially, they were spacing the gap. Whereas I think non-linearity for me, and a much richer agenda, is compiling the interval. And it's a fundamental difference in the thought processes. When you compile the interval, the next move is feeding back on this move. Nothing is independent of each other. There is a dependency, an interdependency. And though you may not see it, spaces compiled like that, I think, are more interesting than if you assumed space was a void. I have always taken as a metaphor that space is infinitely dense and in ultimate terms knotted, so dense that it's a knot. And when we invent in architectural terms, we are unraveling strands of those knots. I use that as a kind of a poetic metaphor, but it is to try and inculcate in my work and in my students as well that architectural elements are revealing space being generated as against space being empty, and I set a boundary around it and then I puncture it.
You know, to consolidate the conversation to this point, we've discussed a little bit the negotiation of the fog of experience and observable data. And the thing that we possibly employ to negotiate through the fog are conceptual models. And non-linearity is one amongst many. So at this point, I would like to cue up this amazing, visualization, I guess, is the cheap way of saying it, or just a kind of zoom-in depiction of what's happening at the cellular model. This was done, I believe, at a study at Harvard University. Is that correct?
Yes, by the Howard Hughes Foundation with Harvard, yes.
Okay, so what I'd like to do is just to, so we could see some of what we're talking about here kind of on the periphery, we're going to play this and ask Peter Davies to be our tour guide a little bit and to explain what we're seeing.
Well, I can't give you a seminar on cell biology in such a short time, of course, but what the takeaway message from this is, first of all, one of scale. And there are two scales. The first scale is shown here, and that is cells in the blood, some of them at the periphery, and they're rolling over a surface of lining of the blood. And that's what we as cell biologists really regard as a macro scale. And here you see now a scale lower where the surface of the rolling cell is coming into juxtaposition with the cells it's going to interact with, and now at the molecular level is engaging specific proteins in order to anchor it to the cell that it's going to move through. It's going to move through the monolayer of cells that it's come into contact with. So at the molecular scale, we have a very complex series of events. And what's going on inside both of these cells is that there are membranes, those membranes, that sea of lipids and sea of proteins, constantly in motion. And this is the second message of this, not just scale, but dynamics, because everything that's going on in the cell all the time has a rate constant attached to its dynamic turnover, whether it's slow or fast, and some indeed are extremely fast. And some are going on, all of what you're seeing here is going on constitutively, it's going on all the time, it's not something. We're not looking at a superimposed signaling event which accelerates some of these processes. And here you're seeing probably spectrin or a molecule in the cortical giving structure to that membrane, which is lipids and proteins, which doesn't have much in a scientific sense. But in fact, the cytoskeleton, such as this example shown here, which is probably actin filaments throughout the cell and underneath the membranes, gives the cell its structural characteristics. But in turn, these elements are also dynamic, as you'll see in a moment. They're constantly being formed and unformed. Here you see them actually as being polymerization of these filaments. And you see that the individual units coming together to form a filament of defined structure and, of course, that subsequent function. In a moment, you'll see the opposite of that, because in parts of the cell where this is going on, there will be other parts of the filamentous network, which gives the cell structure, which involves a cleavage event. And here's an enzyme now, which is going to cleave that structure, and there it dissociates. So you see disassembly of, and it falls apart, can fall apart under controlled conditions. The opposite of that elsewhere in these filaments is self-assembly. And here it may be catalyzed distantly from this particular site, or it may in fact be spontaneous self-assembly, the lowest free energy state being desirable. And elsewhere you'll see disassembly, where the units, again, for reasons which may be entirely local, perhaps a local pH shift, are causing this change. Those filaments are pathways in the cell, and one pathway is carried out by motor proteins, and these proteins actually behave and look as in this diagram, believe it or not. They're like two large feet. In fact, in reality, their motion is more of a sliding motion than lifting up completely, because you've got more control that way. But they bind on their upper side to these great big balls, and these great big balls are pieces of membrane in which there are surface proteins, there are proteins and other molecules captured from outside the cell and are brought into the cell. Those spike things you see are microtubules, which is another element of the cytoskeletal system which gives the cell structure. Here we're looking at the nuclear membrane, and DNA is being read inside the membrane, and RNA is coming out through the nuclear pores and is moving into the other parts of the cell, where it allows it to be transcribed into the code read, transferred through the RNA, for protein synthesis. And you're seeing now the assembly of some of the elements which allow this reading process to occur. And you'll see that as these proteins assemble, and you know, what's lacking in this video is exactly how they get there. We don't really understand what controls how they move. It's not just diffusion. There's clearly ordered and motion and directed motion. Again, very dynamic events. Here's a pair of proteins coming together, some of it newly synthesized, and the RNA will come along in the endoplasmic reticulum, and it will make new protein, which will then pass through a pore into the endoplasmic reticulum organelle. Again, in the cell, there are these large organelles of various functions. Here you see the code being read as it goes through, like a ticker tape, and then underneath you see the protein reading that code, synthesizing the protein, and releasing it into the new space within the cell. So there are compartments within compartments, and the whole thing is dynamic. When those proteins need to be shipped to the cell surface, perhaps they're synthesizing a surface protein, yet here we are deep in the cell, they get enclosed into, again, these vesicles, these large vesicles, and along comes our friend to pick them up and transform and move them into appropriate locations so that they can get to the surface. They get processed, first of all, through other large organelles, such as a system called the Golgi system, where they can be further modified to make them exactly what the cell needs on the surface. So the protein is synthesized, and then the protein is modified. It's called post-translational modification. And then these motor proteins take them to the surface. The membranes fuse, and out pops both soluble molecules and new surface proteins, these yellow things, which now decorate the surface and allow the whole process of internalization and externalization to maintain the cell. But please note the dynamics of this system is absolutely spectacular. It's complex, it's ordered, it's directed. It has an element of uncertainty about it, which is something we might discuss in architecture and biology, but it functions. And indeed, it functions in such a directed way that what you see here is what is called a lipid raft on the surface, whereby those proteins are preferentially in an area of high cholesterol, in this case, in the membrane. So again, there are domains which are being manipulated. These all have form of a kind, which fits some of the definitions that Cecil came up with. And indeed, as we go back now to the macro level, you see this white cell. It's now going to engage the cell layer. It's going to flow into the gap between the cells, the junctions, and it's going to enter the new space, all of it driven by some of these processes that we've observed. And there it goes. So I'll stop at that point. But the message is scale, multiple scale, dynamics, and compartmentalization in space, all elements of a cellular system, and, of course, subcellular events. And this scale, I think, is a scale which is well worth exploring in terms of parallels and transformations towards architectural design, because it's nature's design. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter.
Peter, can I ask what causes the propulsion, that spectacular propulsion out of the nucleus? Is there a gradient, environmental gradient, or acid gradients, or what causes that?
Not clearly understood. It's often attributed to diffusion, but it clearly is not diffusion.
Okay,
but
it's quite...
Yeah, well, there is a caveat to this, and that is that there are thermal gradients within a cell, and these lead to movement, which are thermally driven convective flow. So, but how do you get it so directed to where it's supposed to go, and it does go there more times than not, then that really is a mystery. The great, I think, threshold in cell biology of understanding how a cell functions, to me, is understanding the spatial, the temporal spatial relationships of the dynamics of the cell. And, you know, classically, just as in architecture, you have sections, in biology, you've had this concentration on static images which ignore the dynamics. And now the technology allows us to go into real cells and watch some of these processes and deduce, not design, but deduce the spatial-temporal relationships.
No, and I think in terms of, you know, since this is about models, we are at a nexus now where we're moving from studying cells even in two dimensions to studying them in three. And Bob Weinberg, who is quite a big player at MIT in cancer biology, has stated quite clearly that signaling in 2D, while studying cell processes in 2D, is probably going to be viewed as being quaint, if not archaic. And then you start to think about the ramifications of that for drug testing, that is done in 2D. Cells don't live in a two-dimensional setting. They live in a three-dimensional setting. So we're absolutely at this point now where dynamics and three-dimensionality have to re-enter the fray for us to be able to reinterpret these systems. And the results are surprisingly different.
Also, what I got out of that video was that it seemed to be that there were individual geometries to units, very small units, that completely governed what actually happened then in terms of the forms being built. Mm-hmm. And it's an interesting take. We think of forms being made in a way outside, like an abstract sort of imposition on space.
Right.
But there you actually see it happening where individual geometries seem to come together, if they come together, and then create new architectures.
Well, if you were given a DNA template, say from a human with 25 to 30,000 genes, so this is your sort of brief. I want you to design a modular building using 30,000 individual units interspersed amidst junk, which isn't junk. This thing's going to be moving as well, and it's going to be relocating as you're trying to design it. And the client is going to, at will, remove components or modify them, change the design when you're asleep, and you have to come back and pick up and do it all again. And then the building itself is intrinsically going to change. It's going to move from block to block, but internally it's going to rewire constantly. And that's what we're trying to understand as cell biologists in development and disease and homeostasis. And we want to capture that movement. It also makes it incredibly difficult, but sort of modularity and dynamics, three-dimensionality and what constitutes form are all questions that we're similarly interested in.
Something that is fascinating in the description of the phenomena is that, from your end at least, the problem of form and function is perhaps not as polarized as it might be on the other side of the fence here, maybe less so these days, right? But before we move on, I was wondering if maybe each of you could speak directly to just a hard question. What is a form? And is it something that could be put into a soundbite here?
In a soundbite?
I might steal Cecil's definition from this afternoon, but I'll...
What did I say this afternoon?
You said it was a tension between volume and surface.
Right, yeah, that's one of the definitions. form is a dynamic for me. I don't think it's about shape, talking about architecture. What is an architectural form? It's not about the shape. That's a literalness. Form has something to do with the configuration in space of a connectivity. And it's the rhythm of those connectivities that provoke these deeper resonances that I talk of, where we say some buildings feel great and others don't. And that can be done in the classical sense in terms of embedding different scales at different levels. And it's always form is also very complex because it has different layers in it. It's never a one-statement thing. And so for me, one of the tests of form is the tension between surface and volume. And that's a very intriguing area if you look at the work. It's the battle between the volumetric feel of spaces against the surface. And that's an area that's not been charted very much in architecture. But I think there's an interesting area there of study. And I think there is a clue to what makes a good form and not a good form. But it's actually more intangible, in a sense, for me. Form is sort of the feeling of deeper archetypes being raised there without you being able to put your finger on it. But it's something to do with configuration and connectivity. That's what it is for me.
I mean, I don't think we're that far off in that respect. I mean, I think what we know what the form ought to look like. We study blood vessel formation, so essentially how do you form a tube? We know what a tube looks like, but what is the process to get there? That's what we're really seeking. So you can, you know, take this and you can roll it up. It's one way to do it. That's quite nice. Simple. You can put cells next to each other and then create a hole through the center of those. You can sort of cave in onto yourself. You could maybe start a vacuole at one end which moves to the other. So form, I think, means, for us, not only means the distribution of space and volume and the energy between those, but also the process that allows you to achieve that final form. Again, going back to, you know, how do you capture that? It's extremely difficult. And as I interact more with architects and designers, particularly at Penn, I certainly get the sense that this sort of the remnant of leaving behind the dynamics of the process is something attainable and desirable. I don't know if that's something you would agree with.
Leaving the dynamics?
I mean, a memory of the dynamics or the yes. process is equally as beautiful as
yes.
the final form.
Absolutely.
And yeah. I think that's true. In
For me, yes,
too.
Absolutely.
Well, earlier today we had a review of a class that is taught in the Department of Architecture with Cecil and Jenny Sabin called Form and Algorithm. I was wondering if first Jenny would like to respond to this and then also Peter Davies after.
Yeah. My comments and questions in regards to this question have to do with, one, intuition, two, technology, and three, code. And Cecil, you describe intuition as, or you have in the past, as knowing where to look. And Peter, you have expressed concerns about as our tools become increasingly more sophisticated for how we visualize patterns, dynamics, et cetera, that potentially our intuition, our ability to see, to know where to look, becomes dampened a bit by the technology. So in terms of speaking about code, again, Cecil, at a lecture you gave in Seattle once, you talked about In order to raise your intuition, you went back to the Greeks to understand. So when do you know, when do you trace back to the archetypes to understand how to move forward into the unknown? Where is technology difficult, and when is it helpful in intuiting form and not just shape?
Wow. It's about three questions in there.
It's time for another martini.
Yeah, time for another martini. I only had one before this event. I should have had two. God, let me just think through that. Where is code? Code, I don't know if people, the recent trend in architectural schools is to be able to script the way you make a form. So you don't have to assume how to do it. You can actually write a script, and it finds its way and makes a form. And in that sense, there's a lot of debate whether the code governs what you're doing or whether somehow architecture is above the code, and it's not just governed by coding. I certainly don't think it's governed by coding. I'm not a biologist, and I don't understand cell biology except for looking at my son's biology books when he was studying biology, and I was fascinated by it. But if I understand it, and forgive me if I get this wrong, if you take the model of the cell and the sort of cytoskeleton that's in the stuff I saw in your lab, and the nucleus, and then the extracellular matrix, the stuff that goes outside the cell. For me, the code has been the given that is the cytoskeleton between the nucleus and the extracellular matrix. So the code is the branching, coiling, whatever happens that gives you a set pattern that generates the skeleton, the cytoskeleton. That's not architecture. That's certain mechanical properties being set up. In the nucleus of the cell is what I would call the archetypes, which are buried deep in there. And extracellular matrix, the stuff that goes outside the cell in a diffuse way through the membrane, is more the fleshing of architectural detail. So intuition in that is engaging wholly with the cytoskeleton. And in there, you get more you engage with it and how coding works and how pattern recognition works. You get a hint of what's really deep in the nucleus, which are the archetypes. And you raise your own intuition levels to make choices then, to move towards an aesthetic that you're looking for, a very broad aesthetic feeling. That is when you're making a building or a component of a building.
Peter Davies, just wanted to give you a chance to respond to this.
I may be horribly wrong in my analogy, but...
No, I don't want to cut Cecil off. I think he was going the right way. But one distinction, I think, between biology and architecture and design is the dynamics of the system. So the cytoskeleton and the analogy in architecture of structure is somewhat more fixed, maybe totally fixed, may not be.
Not coding, though. No.
Right.
Coding's flexible.
Right. But in the coding in the cell, which defines that a cytoskeleton will exist and an extracellular matrix will exist, is just the beginning. Because as we heard during the NSO meeting, and Peter eloquently presented at that, there are epigenetic regulations of all of these elements which arrived in one form because of the code, but then are in a dynamic, because of the dynamics of the system, are subject to change, including structural change, such as some of the dynamics I showed you with the cytoskeleton, which are extraordinarily important for the function of the cell and the tissue that it occupies. And Peter's work on extracellular matrix, for example, which can be modified both by extrinsic factors, nothing to do with the cell that made it, but also can be modified by the cell that made it, has tremendous ramifications for the what's called the differentiated properties of that cell, the the phenotype of that cell, what that cell is doing as a cell. So you have in biology both genetic and epigenetic influences coming to bear in a different way that you do in architecture. And that's not, you know, that's quite, I think, an interesting contrast to explore at some point. But I have a question, Cecil, because I was intrigued by your point on nonlinearity and it relates to Jenny's point too. You said walking, you know, exit and entry to a building is perhaps, you know, nonlinear. And to me, it kind of triggers off, well, form that you're looking at as you go through a building or you observe a building from outside depends on your perspective. It depends on your location. And that's never, ever going to be the same in two different people or in the same person at any one time. So two questions come up. What is the aesthetic of form as opposed to the reality of form? And I'm probably choosing a wrong word, but I think you grabbed the concept. In other words, aesthetics, I assume, are subjective. But for form to work in architecture, as you walk through a building or you observe a building from many different angles, does the form have to work for all those angles and perspectives in order to be a successful form?
I would say first that form doesn't have an aesthetic, and that shape has. And so when you're in an architectural enclosure and moving through space, the more prescribed your movements are, it becomes progressively linear. You know, it can be pushed down absolute corridors, the long extrusion architecture we know. But if it's more flexible in its forms, and from 1930s that happened, then the nonlinearity, as I said, is in how you engage with that and what is the aesthetics of that. That will be to do with proportion and rhythmic flavor. That's the aesthetic one would get through the shape. The form itself, I would posit in my definitions, has no aesthetic. And to just to be controversial there, and to go back, I didn't mean to. I mean, I know you, the biology is absolutely infinitely more complex in its dynamic systems than anything we deal with. But what I used the analogy was of coding, because coding is misunderstood. Coding architectural forms today, where you write the script, and the script is highly dependent on the local start point. A minute variation in where you start gives a very different form. And I was using the analogy of the cell because I think, for me, coding is like that. It's between the nuclear secrets, the sort of things you can't quite get at in the nucleus, and the extra detail which is surrounding everything, which you can see. Between those two things, the intangible core, what I call archetypes, and the external surround, which is the materialities of architecture, is coding. And an engagement with coding wholeheartedly, I think, and the sort of seminars we're running at Penn today, and what Jenny runs, is to engage with searching, engaging with your intuition for form. So it's a long answer back to that thing. It's to Jenny's question as well about intuition. I think intuition is not a chance thing. It has its own structures. It has probability structures. And you sharpen your intuition by engaging with probability structure. And coding, an algorithmic form, is just that. So
do you think there is an algorithm for a sort of deeper truth and understanding of aesthetics?
No, there isn't. It's the in-between zone between a deeper archetype, which we can't chart, and the detail we flesh things with. In between is pattern generation. Mm-hmm. And that's what coding does today and what we see every time we recognize things. It's pattern recognition. And I mean, we haven't talked about scale. I think Peter or someone mentioned scale. I think a new aesthetic as well is a question of recognizing scale at different levels embedded simultaneously in it. It's so that you get small scale and big scale, and they both are components of the piece. Mm-hmm. And they're working at different levels with their own rules almost.
Mm-hmm. I think one concern that's sort of been raised, at least on the boundaries of our conversations as biologists and architects, designers, engineers, has been the scalability and how can we transfer information. And I think at this point we just don't know. As the examples that do exist, and I think there are plenty of examples, of course, of biology turning to architecture, often dreadful. But coming back the other way, those models have been incredibly powerful, and I think that's something else we absolutely need to explore. I don't know if Jenny wants to.
Well, something that came up today in the course of the review for the Form and Algorithm seminar was the question of scale as it relates to stable versus unstable, and that that as you move through various resolutions or various scales, that if there was a shift in the pattern recognition, that it represented an unstable model, and then if there was not, then that was a stable model. So my interest lies potentially maybe not in how do we scale up, but what is the relationship between scale and stability versus the unstable?
No, though I feel like we're only beginning, and we'll.
You're telling me we've got to end now, right?
Yeah, we'll probably be at that point, you know, for the next year or so, where we begin to probe each other more, and with greater seriousness, progressively. But just as a first step, there, I'd like to bring you the final question: is what can we work on together?
To me.
To us? I think first okay. To Cecil and Peter.
Okay.
And I would also like to get the viewpoints of the respondents, Peter and Jenny also.
Right. Well, Peter gave me some papers to read when I was in his studio lab a few weeks ago on cells and the kind of work that he thought I'd be interested in. My intuition is that... Well, first I'd like to say that biology and what it's doing is highly attractive to architecture, always has been. It's intricate, it's at many levels, so it's a no-brainer in a way to be interested in biology in a way. And it's highly structural and, you know, it's got all sorts of architectures in it, which nature has always been the paradigm, and now we revealed in the Harvard film amazing stuff there. But it is a dynamic system, as Peter said, highly dynamic, and it's erroneous to just think we can copy those processes into architecture. We absolutely can't, and it's dangerous, because a building has got static elements and functional elements that are stable. But having said that, I think where the NSO was set up in the belief that science has great analytical powers, ahead of architecture in a sense. But architecture has high synthetic powers, synthesis. And my intuition is looking at those papers, and as I said, I'm not a biologist or scientist in that sense, is that in the modeling, the sort of stuff we saw today in the Form and Algorithm seminar at Penn, my intuition is there are modeling techniques there that can give an insight into better modeling for the biologists to understand cell behavior. And just in a very early presentation that Peter gave me, about 1 hour's presentation in his lab, I asked certain questions that sensed, and he agreed with me, there were deficiencies in his modeling, the way they present these things in biology.
I made the mistake of showing Cecil a 2D model.
Yeah, and, of a 3D complex organism.
Hated it, so.
Yeah, but I think my intuition is that's where we could do something together. There could be an interesting project there. I don't know if we'll find the answer because biology is so dynamic and constantly changing, and it'll need very sophisticated modeling. But it will be definitely nonlinear in its organizational characteristics.
I mean, I in the search for sort of deliverables. And end points for, or beginning points for this intersection. It's difficult. We're exploring a number of things. Jenny Sabin and I are looking at ways in which to reinterpret pathological data. Can you take these disordered patterns that are presented, say, on a breast cancer specimen and create something more palpable and recognizable, more instantly recognizable, at least for the uninitiated person? Not that a pathologist would have a problem with that. But I was really struck today. I think it's a matter of just spending time together and carving out that time and realizing that it's as important as anything else that we do, NIH funding aside. But today, I just wanted to talk about one of the projects I saw in your studio class.
Seminar.
By Jackie Wong, and he showed this. He's a ice dancer and architect and computational guy from, I think, Stanford originally. I don't know if he's here. But he showed something that was really remarkable to me. We're interested in different ways in which cells move, and not all cells move in the same way. So metastatic breast cells move very differently from lymphocytes that Peter just showed. They move very differently if they're normal cells versus whether they're tumor cells. So cells have a dance, a signature dance. And what Jackie showed was an application of an algorithm for various, I think, 74 different ice dances.
Yeah.
Using generative components and work through Cecil and Jenny's seminar, stroke workshop, stroke studio. And, you know, he could show differences, amazing differences between, for example, the Yankee polka and the polka and the golden waltz. And these patterns were recognizable and different. And so immediately, as a cell biologist interested in migration, one thinks, okay, well, cells dance different. Can we use that information to generate patterns that will even be predictive for cell behavior and then thinking about translation into therapeutics? Can you take a cell, analyze its dance, and tell that patient whether they their prognosis? So just even scratching the surface, and I walked in halfway through that process, the more time I spend with you, the more I realize that we absolutely need to forge out some formal and continue to generate more formal interactions. I think it's an opportunity. I think it's very specific to being at Penn as well. I think we're at an incredible moment in time with department chairs and presidents and directors who are amazingly supportive of this. And we have to do it properly and rigorously. And I think we'll get somewhere that way.
Yeah, I'd like to think so. I mean, as against looking at each other across a gap and saying, that's interesting. And I think I'm heartened by the way Peter and you have engaged in, you know, what Jenny's been doing and what we've been doing at Penn, because I think it's always been the other way, as in architecture, we've been interested in biology and models, but never really engaged with it.
Right.
I think we have a chance with your work as well to do something. I think we should.
Yeah. Well, we're also very lucky to have a chair, Mark Tkaczynski, who's sitting on the front row, who has also collaborated with a lifelong friend, Toby Kahn, who's a fine artist. And they've talked about the dynamic border in paintings and cells. And so there is this precedent at Penn, and I relish it, and I'm very grateful for it.
Yeah.
I was wondering if I could get some closing observations from the table, from maybe from Peter Davies first, and then Jenny Sabin after.
Well, Cecil and Peter, I think, have said it very well in terms of the interactions between the very different interest areas. The commonality is that those of us engaged with you are very interested in everything, and you are very interested in everything. And that's a very good place to start. The fascination which certainly the message which intrigues me as on the biological side is the dynamics of living systems. The fact that they constantly need energy to be generated, they constantly use energy, and they constantly mostly observe the laws of physics until you get down to very, very small dimensions, and then some of that slips away. But we, as biologists, are not designers, and you, as architects, are designers. And this is a difference which, of course, is absolutely implicit. So we would like to see, really, the tools, and Cecil, you said it very well in the seminar this afternoon, said it very well, too, whereby putting functions, looking at mathematical geometric functions, which are relevant to some of the dynamics of the systems that we look at in biology, can be tested out. And Peter said the same thing. Okay, and so I fully endorse that. The question is, you know, can we use some of those, learning from those models, to constrain the dynamics of a living system in a different way? So we talk about therapy. People talk about therapy, and it can be drug therapy. It can be all kinds of interventions. But there may be some conceptual, initially, and possibly practical application of knowledge gained from these algorithmic approaches, which will allow us to think differently in terms of constraining the cell. Because what we're trying to do is two things. One is to understand how all this complexity works in a cell. And number two, if possible, bring it to the benefit of mankind, which is what medicine is about. So I think those distinctions are apparent.
Yeah, I mean, I think for myself, I mean, the beginning is the exchange, the conversation, and the defining of terms, which I think is quite engaging and interesting. And I mean, out of the course of even just this conversation, you know, four terms: code, intuition, technology, and modeling become quite interesting. And to go back to something you've said in the past, Peter, the fear that potentially sophisticated technologies are hampering your ability to see. How might our way of tooling provide new ways of seeing? And further, in terms of thinking about the dynamics of structure, absent of scale, how might the understanding of the intrinsic relationship of geometry to matter and forces moving through that matter, how might we have a conversation that gives rise to mutual ways of thinking about understandings of chaos versus regularity and design within that? So for me, it's currently finding our way through the fog and understanding those key terms that will lead, I know, to very sophisticated understandings of how it becomes applied.
It strikes me as a possibility that I hadn't considered. From architectural field, there has been curiosity about the mimesis of biological matter, that we learn what we can from research in biology and scale up the models and see what we could do as architectural models. But this possibility that Peter brought up going in the opposite direction is, I think, equally interesting, that kind of design intelligence that is perhaps native to architecture might actually go in the opposite direction as a form of artificial intervention in the organization. Did I understand this correctly?
Yes, you did. And actually, there's a distinction here, because all the time we use engineering principles, we use biomechanics to model the cytoskeletal structure function, for example, in cells, Lagrangian approaches and so on. Okay, those are hard and fast rules of engineering which are very useful in interpreting how a cell works. What I'm suggesting is that it's removed as into the abstract. And it's a point, I think, that was driven in very strongly in this afternoon's seminar, that indeed one can work with abstract functions, and which then, on further analysis, generates certain shapes, forms, which some of which I think we can make very relevant to some of the things going on in the cell.
Thank you. Any last words before we take a few questions from the audience, Cecil and Peter?
We should probably just do the questions.
Okay, good. Right. So we have time to take maybe
a question. Just a brief one. For those of us who are interested in seeing that video again, is that available in the public domain?
Yeah, it is.
We could, I guess, arrange to have a link.
It's on the web, and if anyone wants to email me or email David or Eric, they all have the address for the website.
Does the Slot Foundation have a website?
Yeah, we could have permission.
Okay, we'll post the link to it.
It's in the public domain.
Question? Please.
Absolutely.
As a way of analyzing the problems in the growth of the city, living in a city, certainly well aware of that.
No, I mean, I think that yeast network doesn't look much different to a city center in many ways.
And the question about interventions, too.
Right.
Yeah, I think there's a very close parallel there. It's, for sure, it's city growth is an organic thing. We know that. Mm-hmm. And when you try to plan the city right from start to finish, I mean, it kills it off. In England, we have classic disasters where cities were planned in 1946 to be great utopian cities, and they don't work. And cities that work are those that have just grown through organic principles. And I'm sure if you look at them and look at their maps, they do look like cellular organizations, or, you know, to the amateur eye anyway. And I think the principles there is a sort of an interesting area to study. We touched briefly on that at the London School of Economics Urban Studies Group there, but not really deeply enough. But yeah, I think there's a rich area there for sure.
Helen.
In terms of the urban, there are a lot of people right now who are beginning to really argue that cities need to be modelled and understood as complex systems, as non-linear complex systems. And so in that case, there's a direct convergence. And one of the things that really interested me was to discover the models of an urban simulation by a man called Michael Batty, who is actually at the Bartlett in London, looking almost identical in terms of their organisation and their logic to models that Peter had shown me of intercellular behaviours. And I think that's a really, really sort of interesting convergence, a radically different scale, but very, very similar organisations. My question actually has to do, to go back to the early discussion about the difference between linearity and non-linearity. Within complexity theory, which is, of course, you know, computationally based, the distinction, at least as I understand it, is between a system or a logic or a structure that can be represented, in other words, that can be described by a finite equation, and one that can't, in other words, one that is not reducible to an equation. Right? And the distinction in those is that in one case you can literally represent, this can be mapped identically in the linear situation. In the nonlinear situation, you cannot, and this, you know, Cecil rightly pointed out the fact that this is an unpredictable system. What you end up having to do is to either simulate or to model, right? That's the only form of representation available to you. And I guess there's a distinction that Eric has on the table here about the distinction I know between diagram and model. And I guess a simulation for you may not be exactly equivalent to a model, or they may be variants of each other. But I guess the question for me is in those terms, when for all of you, and you know, for Cecil at the level of complex structures, but for those of you dealing with the complexity of the body, is really that question of whether of what kind of forms of modelling you use, and whether simulation, whether this inability to exactly produce something, reproduce something, is something that is becomes significant in your worlds in terms of how you begin to think about how you map things.
So, Helene, if I'm understanding the question right, the question is about how do they use models in the
no,
work?
No, it's a question that's related to nonlinearity and the sort of demand that a nonlinear system can only be simulated, can only be modeled, can't be reproduced, right? And I'm wondering what that means in the context.
Are you saying that as a statement, it can't be reproduced? Right.
I
mean, I think that's the definition of a model, isn't it? It doesn't necessarily have to reproduce every and single aspect. I mean, one of the things that we do is in our studies examining breast cancers, we take normal breast epithelial cells and put them in a three-dimensional matrix, and they do a lot of what they ought to do. They polarize, they form a lumen. If you give them lactogenic hormones, they'll secrete milk into a lumen. So if you want to study milk production, that's one good way. If you want to study tumor formation, you can add genes or proteins to that environment that are associated with tumors and watch the behavior of those structures or models change. And then what we all do, I think, as life scientists, is rigorously retest those ideas using human specimens, either biopsies or autopsy material, and animal models also, which are still incredibly important, unfortunately, but that is the case. So you get close to what you might wish, and you ignore the stuff that doesn't work, but you test it repetitively and repeatedly in other systems until you're sure.
Any other comments relative to the question?
Yeah, just to follow up on the biology side. Chaos is in physiology, that is not pathological states, but in physiology is very rare. There are occurrences of it. For example, blood flow in certain locations is chaotic. It's called turbulence. Okay? And it creates all kinds of problems because it's unpredictable. But coming to models and algorithms, let me propose an approach which might benefit the biologist. And again, it's a very abstract proposal. But if one takes a series of functions, which are then, and algorithms, which are then explored purely in an architectural sense, a form and shape sense, as we saw this afternoon, and try to apply them to biological systems, we can use our intuition, which is kind of educated guesswork, I suppose, our experience and knowledge of biological systems, to have a sense of where these might be important, and then to actually impose filters, restrictions, convergence ideas to try to bring the two together. And I don't know how you do that right now, but I think I could come up with some ideas. So it's very tangible, and we could do that for both nonlinear, that is chaotic systems, purely defined, and we could do it for very ordered algorithmic progressions, that some of which we've seen today. And I think, you know, there is certainly, it would occupy one's downtime from other things very effectively to think about some possibilities in that direction.
We have time for one last question. Detlef Mertens.
There's no distinction. I mean, it's ordered and controlled, but there's no, in principle, the same processes are being used.
But are they making a habitat?
They're maintaining a habitat, and indeed, in the initial post-conception period of cellular development, that they are creating that habitat, yes.
I think, again, we're at a point of a paradigm shift in biology where the weight to the microenvironment is as equal to the code. Absolutely, the habitat is constantly renewed, maintained, and essential, and changes very early on when tissues and cells change with disease. So I think that this sort of goes back to one of the questions we're interested in is something that you've, I think, posed in a sort of more macro scale is, you know, can architecture heal? And we're very interested in those questions. Can cytoarchitecture, or knowledge of cytoarchitecture and environments been used to heal? So that's, again, something that Jenny and I started to discuss.
Yeah, I think Detlef raises an interesting point. I think a building is a habitat in that sense. Where I was talking about nonlinearity before in the whole building process is that the relationships within the habitat have an aesthetic function as well, which for me we better express in a nonlinear sense. But the habitat nature, Detlef, if you're trying to provoke a sense of static sense in habitat being made, not necessary, right? Habitat is a very dynamic system, but it's the right word for architecture, I think.
But the difference is that the organism is presumably making itself, whereas the habitat, I thought, was made by us or other things around as well, and maybe the line seems to be blurable.
Yeah.
I think what's interesting to follow that within the context of the question, can architecture heal, was that through the course of the studio that you led that dealt with that question, the overarching conclusion was that the patient was the hospital, the patient was the architecture, the patient was the environment. And I think that's an interesting one in terms of thinking about how you begin to model you know, if you're going to look at the more stable states of health, that you must look at the unstable and the complex in order to understand that it's both environment and structure.
Yeah, I think Jenny commented on that earlier. It was raised at our review today, this stability and instability. I think there's a whole area there that's hardly been looked at. What is stable and what is unstable in what on the surface looks not chaotic, but unstable itself. But actually, if you look at it, there's stability within certain patterns and instability in others. And it's to do with the embedment of ordered scales at different levels. Mm-hmm. A fractal is stable in an interesting way because it's ordered at different scales and you can understand them. Mm-hmm. And they don't have any sudden break, otherwise it wouldn't be a fractal. It wouldn't come together and cohere at different levels of organization. And that whole area, I think, is an interesting area to study. Certainly, I think, between us as well, must be an area to work at.
Let me ask you, Cecil, do you view unstable as being unsuccessful? Is unstable unsuccessful?
No.
No.
No. It's a transition area between one stability to another, for me.
Mm-hmm.
It's a measure of turbulence, which could run off into a total instability and so not cohere.
You sound like a pathologist.
Usually it's transition.
So.
I sound like a pathologist.
You sound like a cellular pathologist.
Okay.
So, just in closing, I guess we could safely expect that any work that we do together will begin to have the function of dissolving some of these polarized distinctions that have been operating from, say, our end as architects and then perhaps from the other side in pathology. So perhaps there's just tremendous benefit in looking in between these polar opposites. And so with that, I would like to thank the conversants and the respondents and to our audience for coming to this fascinating event.
Thank you.
I also want to thank you all for coming out on behalf of SLOT. I know the conversation was admittedly wide-ranging and complex. The recording will be available on the website in the days ahead, and we encourage you to consult that. And the recording that Peter Davies had the video, will also be made available there. The size of this audience and the attentiveness over the past 2 hours speaks to how much gratitude we have for each of you sharing your evening with us and your work. But it's also the case that, again, thank you for all coming out tonight. So feel free to come up and continue this conversation.